House Committee on Human Services and Women's Wellness, February 20, 2008, 8 a.m., Hearing Room F.
On Human Services and Women's Wellness, today on February 15, 2008. And we have Brian Johnson here, and is Mickey? Mickey is...
He's taking a copy, Madam Chair, if you will return momentarily. Upon his return, we're going to pass out three pieces of paper that will straighten out, Madam Chair, some matters from yesterday. For the record, my name is Brian Johnston. I'm the Assistant Director of the Department of Human Services in charge of the CAF Division. One of the things I'd like to straighten out from yesterday was that yesterday I said 13 months in relationship to movement for termination of parental rights. My staff, on the way back to the building, pointed out to me that it is 13 months when our staff is to prepare the documents. It's actually 15 months that they're to move. Once a child has been in foster care for 15 of any 22-month period, the federal government requires us to move for termination of parental rights. So my apologies for that two-month glitch. And Mickey Cerise is going to pass out some materials that also speak to our testimony yesterday.
And we're bringing additional copies of that staffing study here in a few minutes if you don't have one.
I'm not sure in what order you've received them, but let me go through the documents. One is a packet by counties of some of the measures that were used in the federal review study. Representative Maurer yesterday asked if we had anything like that, and this is our first stab at it. We'll make a more professional stab later, but this gives you at least an illustration. This is on various pieces of it. For example, the first one is time to finalize adoptions, and then there's reunification statewide by county, etc. So each of the documents going through. A second document is reasons children enter foster care, and it's divided from physical abuse to drug abuse to various, and you can trace the last year we have information compiled for us, 2006. We're working on 2007 now, but that gives you an idea of the motivations for why we made the decision to remove a child. And then the final document is entitled Drug Abuse Impact on Foster Care in Oregon. It, too, stops in 2006. We're in the process of doing 2007, but it shows you that the number of children entering foster care has increased by about 50% from 2000 to 2005, with the primary reason for removal of parental drug abuse.
Wow.
Jeez.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Coach.
And a good portion of that is alcohol abuse, am I correct?
I think, Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, that this is A&D treatment, so alcohol would be included.
Yes, Chair Tomei and Representative Kotek. Right now, our database system does not distinguish the drug of choice, so A&D does include alcohol and drugs. On the back page of that same document, we did try to call out methamphetamine use, because that was such a... That was a question we were receiving over the last several years, and this was our best estimate of the methamphetamine use when it was identified as the drug of choice by the parent who had the child in foster care.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative
Maurer. I hate to ask this question, but I'm going to ask anyway. Is it possible to ask for that information? You know, if you check... It's an alcohol or drug reason. Please give us the drug of choice.
Yes, Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, that's a great question. In fact, we have several community partners that are asking us to do that. In the new database system that is being built and hopefully will be up and running in 2010, we do have an option to put that into place. There's some considerations that are being looked at presently, whether or not we would want to count the drug of choice part of the reasoning is that would delay data entry until the parent did give us that information, and that could cause us some logistical problems as well, but we're still considering that. And in the current system we have right now, it doesn't have that capability, and when I speak with the data people, it never ceases to amaze me what seems to be something that looks pretty simple and I can press a button and get it literally takes hours and several man hours to put that together. So there was a decision not to invest resources into this current database system and wait until we have the new one.
Now, I'm sure that was not a request for more resources.
No.
Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, with your permission, I would like to move then from the federal review study to the child welfare staffing study, the document that I gave you yesterday. Why I suggest this progression is this is the logical chapter two to what you saw yesterday as chapter one. A word about this study. Staffing studies are very typical in the human service arena in an effort to try and find out if you are staffed appropriately for the workload that you have. We have been working with McKinsey and Company under a transformation initiative that is DHS-wide. When we contracted with McKinsey, we asked that the staffing study on child welfare, which we knew was due, if that would be moved to the front, so it would be one of the first tasks that they completed under the contract. And what you have in front of you is a brief overview of that work. They were able to complete it, and I want to walk you through it, if I may. The approach that was taken in this was activity-based. In other words, trying to figure out what is required and what caseworkers actually do. And there were multiple methods there was observation, there were forum groups, and there was a huge collection of questionnaires. 1,200 caseworkers got the questionnaires. Generally, a good response rate would be 50%. We had almost 1,100. We had about 1,080 returned those questionnaires. So it's a pretty phenomenal participatory rate because people don't generally take the time out to do this. The results were compiled, and what you have in front of you is that. If you'll turn to page 3, here's some of the outcome-related federal performance targets. You saw this is taken directly from what you saw yesterday. So what this is a statement, pure and simple, that we don't do our work. We don't do what is expected of us. Then they said, well, how does that compare with other states? We've already told you that so far none of the states have passed the federal review. So the next page compares top U.S. states, compares DHS with other U.S. states, and you'll see on four of the measures that were chosen for comparison, we were in the third quartile, three of them we were in the third quartile, and one of them we were in the second quartile. So by any measurement, Oregon simply is not doing a very good job with these standards. This shouldn't come as a shock to you. We've had two reports. The first one was done in 2005. It was called the Holder Report, named after its author. And in that report that's quoted on the next page, he talks about people not being able to do their work. The quote is, with caseloads exceeding 20 per worker, it could very well be that workers are being expected to do 2 to 3 times what reasonably can be expected, given the complexity and demands for each case. We had a follow-up report by a national organization in 2006, and their quote appears there as well. In general, staff are dedicated and competent, but in many instances, they struggle with heavy workloads and insufficient resources. Turning to the next page, we come to some of the things that have happened recently that have increased that load without increasing any resources. In 2007, we adopted the Oregon Safety Model. The Oregon Safety Model changed significantly the types of activities that caseworkers are supposed to engage in. It moved most responses to reports to 24 hours, where they had previously been 5 days. It created a capacity assessment that was more comprehensive, rigid, and evaluative than was previously used. There was more cross-functional cooperation required. It raised the foster family visits to twice a year instead of once a year, and it required foster parents to undergo training, increased it by about 50%. In 2007, you passed three bills that took effect recently, and those three bills all added tasks. They're in the right-hand column, Senate Bill 412, 414, and House Bill 3113, all added additional requirements to the caseworkers' tasks, and the resources had remained the same, except you added new caseworkers at the same time. So you did... You are to be commended. You not only gave us responsibilities, but you also gave some resources to assist in those. The bottom line, however, is if you look down on the next page, you see a cycle. And McKinsey maintains that this cycle is evidenced throughout our caseworkers in child welfare. And what happens is you get these external triggers, which are like new initiatives or policy requirements, and they push down on the caseworker, and you get two cycles. On the one cycle, workers are becoming less satisfied. That increases turnover and sick leave, and it increases retirements, and people quit, and you wind up with less experienced workers, which pushes down satisfaction and sends that cycle working again. On the other side, you wind up with less hours per case, less effective service, and overall more work per case because you aren't doing a good enough job, and so the case comes back, and that pushes down. So you have these two cycles that continually repeat and continually drive morale and performance downward. So the question is, how do you slow or stop the cycle? On the next page, you see 18 suggestions that McKinsey said would help us close the gap and stop that cycle. Of those 18 suggestions, I have to point out to you, only one of them is add caseworkers. The other 17 are do other things. Change the way you do the work, change the way you assist with the work, evaluate and adopt more effective processes, get a higher share of effective workers, get higher effectiveness out of each individual worker. These 17 things, they say, will significantly, almost entirely, but not quite, significantly close the gap. The page underneath that shows you how the staffing analysis was developed. There were three steps. There was the process mapping that I've already talked about. There was the time activity survey. And February 15th, they finished with the analysis of results. There's some highlights to the survey shown on the next page. Limited face-to-face time. Caseworkers in Oregon spend 30% of their time working directly with clients and collaterals, compared to, for example, 37% in our neighbor to the north. So we are significantly under what would be a standard for the amount of time. That's by significantly, 37 to 30 doesn't sound like much, but it's almost 25%. So it is significant. There was high variation district to district. We talked about this a little bit yesterday. It is a significant reality and one that my office has to get a handle on. There's differences in offices and cases. There's differences in overtime, and all this impacts the outcomes. Now, the next page is probably the most important in the report, I think. It's called the current gap between capacity supply and workload demand. If you start on the left-hand column where it says 100%, that's our current capacity. Given our current caseworkers, our current supervisors, the current support for them, they're capable of doing that amount of work. Okay? The unfortunate reality when you add the next column is based on that 100, there's 117 to 123% of work to be done. So we start with that gap, 17 to 23. And I would allege to you that that's the gap you saw yesterday in the federal report, that our inability to reach those standards is captured at least partially, if not entirely, by that gap. Number two, the next column over, the three bills that I referenced earlier that you added, that adds 1 to 2% to the workload. So now we're up to 118 to 125. If you raise service quality, that adds 3 to 4% to the workload. So now you're up, you know, figuring it out, you've added another 4%. If you take supervisors off of the caseload...
Brian, yes. Let me stop you a second. We have to send in a question.
Brian, raising service quality, how are you measuring that and determining that? I mean, what baseline are you?
Well, for example, the length of time of visits. Right now, almost all our visits are between 30 and 45 minutes. And the national suggestion is that visits should be at least an hour long. So if you go to visit a family, you should spend real time with them instead of coming in and having a cup of tea or whatever, you know, seeing the house, but then leaving quickly. We're trying to, is it an adequate measure? I honestly don't know the answer to that, but it's one of the measures that are used. Can you get your visits of face-to-face time with families up to where they're averaging 1 hour?
Can I follow up from that? How do you plug in the whole idea and the concept of public, I mean, well, try, let's see what I want to say. Ken Blanchard wrote a book several years back that talked about raving fans. And that if you go out and you can work a service to the public or to the community to a point where they are so satisfied, it goes beyond that, public satisfaction, that they become raving fans in your back seat rooting for you. And that's that 7-to-1 ratio theory then of they're going to go tell 7 other people how good you were and everything. How do you get to that point, I mean, with customer satisfaction? Actually, I'm thinking raving fans, really.
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Olson, I that's a very interesting question, and I think the answer to it will depend upon how we define customer or fan. We have a lot of customers. The Judicial Department is a customer of ours. The District Attorneys are customers of ours. The school districts are customers of ours, as are the clients themselves and the children. Okay, so the movement of... I would be most concerned out of the groups I mentioned, I would be most concerned with the kids. If we could get to the point where when we have someone who is 17 or 18 and aging out of the system and they say, thank you, Oregon, I think we'd be working toward what you want. I don't think we're going to get that from parents who think that we have unnecessarily interfered with their life, unnecessarily taking their children from them. I have a case today that I have to talk to one of your colleagues about where the constituents for one of your colleagues is convinced that we are wrong in our and so I was stopped yesterday and asked to check on this case, and I checked on the case, and my staff says to me, we've got two physicians who have seen this child, and they both say the child is not going to prosper, not going to develop appropriately and safely return to the chest. So I've got to say to that person, you know, I'm sorry, your constituents, the evidence doesn't support their position. They're not going to be happy. So I don't know how we move the parents to raving fans.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think that's an interesting line of questioning, especially if we're trying to gauge the satisfaction from the child perspective. And one of the things we could look at is the problem that we see, particularly in Multnomah County, about children who are older children connected with foster care who leave the system and end up on the street, which has been an issue for homeless providers up in the Portland area. And so, you know, are we seeing less kids leaving the system because we're doing a better job of attaching them and providing supports? And so I think one of the things that McKinsey focuses on is figuring out what those indicators are, and I'm assuming that's the next step.
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, you touch on something that's of great interest to mine. I have four children, two of whom are, one's a college graduate, one will be a college graduate in May, and the other two are much younger. But I'm afraid we've created a society where it is the rare individual who at 18 is ready to take on the world. And I know I love my children dearly, but I would suggest to you, I hope none of them are watching, that at 18 they weren't ready to go out into the world without their mother and fathers playing backup. And yet, that's what we do in Oregon. And I'm very worried about everyone's worried about the babies. I'm worried about them too, but I'm worried about the young men and women so that they don't wind up homeless, so they don't wind up in all the other temptations that modern life can put in front of you.
That's a tough one, because at that point they can say they're 18 years old and I'm a free agent and I don't have to stay involved with this agency or any services that you provide for me. I dealt with that a lot whenever it's the agency.
And Madam Chair, if I could just clarify, I do think we need more transitional services for children who age out. I'm talking about kids who should be still in the system and have left which was an issue raised by the Citizens Crime Commission in Portland, concern about people being frustrated with the department. These kids are still wards of the state, to
exactly.
But they're on the street because the system is not serving them well. So.
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, perhaps we could look at some of our universities that have developed excess capacity. And two of our outlying regional universities come to mind, and start funding some services that allow for that type of transition. Mm-hmm. Moving back to my chart, if I may, it was just an idea. at the end of the chart, if you work your way across it, what you see are increasing layers of gap being laid on top of the 17 to 23 that begins the analysis. And so at the end, you're facing a gap of 24% to 37%. Then the question comes up, how do you close the gap? Now, we do not have any expectation, and we are not here today, and we've not asked the legislature to close this gap by adding staffing. If you were to add staffing, just to give you, to sound an alarm, if you were to add staffing, to close this gap, you'd have to add approximately 600 caseworkers to the 1,200 we already have. And that is because when you add a staff, you'll see in a couple pages, we currently get, caseworkers like to do things like take a break and have lunch and take a vacation when it's time, etc. So if you add that out over the course of the year, we get 6 hours of work per day from a caseworker. And that's not atypical. That's not DHS. That's true in all of your businesses. If you factor in all of their breaks and all of their vacation and all of their sick time, you get something less than 8 hours a day spread over the course of a year. So you have to add 1.4 people for 1.4 staff for every 1% of gap you want to close. So if you're going to use adding staff as the gap closing mechanism, it's going to be expensive. So what we're suggesting is that, going back to that page where there were 17 other suggestions other than adding staff, we're suggesting we get the vast majority of our gap closing success from those other things, from the efficiencies, from making the work such that we don't lose workers, so that we don't get people using overtime as much, etc. And we think we can get about 17% of that, and we're using a number of 27. If you remember, the gap was 24 to 37. So we're going to assume it's 27, not quite taking the bottom, but saying it's closer to the bottom. We'll get 17% from that, and that still leaves a 10% gap that has to be closed either by adding staff or, going back the other way, if you add staff and invest in staff doing the right thing, maybe we prevent children from coming into foster care and the caseload goes down safely. That's the key, safely. The caseload goes down and then you don't need that 10%. So I am sitting in front of you saying that what we're trying to do is close this gap without adding staff at all.
Madam Chair, if my math is correct, if you do nothing to change your processes, you're saying add 600 staff. I mean, excuse me, you. The McKinsey report suggests that it's a concern. If you do nothing.
There's an assumption, Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, if you intend to do all the work.
Okay. Follow up. So if you take those 17 measures and you implement those, then you still have a gap in staffing, which should put you between, I'll say, 100 and 150. That you're still going to have to add in order to meet the caseload and meet, assuming you do all the efficiencies. Is that...
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, that would be correct unless, as in the scenario I paint for you, that the... Exactly. Right.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I might phrase it a little differently in that I actually... What I like most about your study is that we do want to fix some of the process issues, because if we threw a lot of new FTE at the program and the current processes, I think we're not going to have the results we want, because we do have to deal with efficiencies and things like that. But we do have other choices. You know, we could say we're okay with not having quality service. We could change some of the requirements that we made. What they're saying here is if you want to buy the system, that meets all of your goals that we keep putting in place for this department and reaches the type of evidence-based service that we want, for example, an hour of FaceTime, because the Holder report said one way to guarantee better outcomes is better face is more FaceTime with the families or the kids, then we have some choices to make. And so when you look at this chart, they give you a variety of ways here. You know, improving efficiency, I think we're going to need a combination. Add some staff, because one of the things with all this kind of change, too, is that puts extra pressure. You know, if you want to create new, process changes that are more efficient, it also happens, and people can't stop what they're doing. And so there's extra stress on the workers. So I think there's going to be a very delicate balance between a little bit of more staffing, more efficiencies, and maybe, frankly, being okay with the fact that we're not going to have the quality of system that we want right now, but maybe we can plan to how do we get there. And that's why I think what they're coming up with in terms of it really gives us some policy choices about what we want the system to look like.
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, I agree with you and would suggest what it also does is it raises your status as an oversight committee. It asks you to help guide us more by being aware of what progress we're making and whether or not that progress is in the direction you want.
Madam Chair, I think, and I have some other comments, but, you know, this is not just about a management decision on. And I mean the quite frankly, the workers and the union is going to have to be involved in this process if we want to ultimately get close to 100% of where we want to be. And so I hope that we are engaging the union because they have avenues of communication with staff that even management doesn't have. And as an encouragement that this is good for everybody. It's not about putting the hammer down. It's about making everybody's life better.
Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, I would say that the union thus far, since I've been there in November, the union has been collaborative and helpful in all regards on this.
I would propose that the legislature has a role in this too, not just in the union.
Madam Chair, if I may, he mentioned the word oversight, and that's a very interesting question because we had this conversation in healthcare yesterday, and the question is, what is our role in oversight? And I think that is still an open question that really hasn't been answered, and we tend to follow the latest crisis. Because I mean, we react to our constituents, but it would be a much better, agreeable position for me to be in front and say, no, yeah, we recognized that problem last year, and this is what we're doing to fix it. But you know, we're citizen legislators, and there is no way that we can engage with you on a daily, monthly basis like you can with your staff. And so, yes, we're oversight, and I'm quite frankly interested in knowing exactly what does that mean and how do I become a better legislator in providing that role of oversight. And that's an education process on my part. What does that all mean to us?
I agree. And when I see problems in different departments, I feel a lot of responsibility on our part that somehow we have allowed this to happen on our watch. And so I think if we want to be partners, that we have to stay engaged and not just respond to emergencies and the local paper reporting.
Totally agree. And you know, we are in a political environment, mm-hmm. and you know, if I can use not to disparage, but you know, quote, we're from the party of better government. The problem is we haven't been terribly successful in that for a number of reasons, and it's because, you know, when you start being a flamethrower, you don't really help the problem. It's about these processes and where we... Okay. My first question to you, Mr. Johnson, is do you think they were measuring the right things? Because you only know, you only look at what you measure.
Madam
My first question to you, Mr. Johnson, is do you think they were measuring the right things? Because you only know, you only look at what you measure.
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, I think that they're measuring revealed problems. I have no questions about that, but I think their snapshot was inadequate. I feel particularly, not that I'm ever going to feel sorry for California, but they did the same thing for California. That's what they do nationally. They took the same number of cases from three counties in California. They took, 17, 17, and 31 from California. Is that a fair snapshot of California? Was this 17-17-31 a fair snapshot of Oregon? I think not. Are the problems they identified real? Yeah, I don't have any trouble with that. Are they systemic and are they... I don't know. And nothing they said convinced me of that. Can we respond to these? We can and we will. We know we have miles to go before we sleep. But, is their analysis particularly insightful or helpful? I would not, if I were paying for it, I would not be satisfied with the results.
So, following up on what you're asking, so how do you have any, not you, you weren't there, Mickey, did you have any input on what issues they would be studying?
During the Child and Family Service review,
right.
The federal review, Representative Tomei, they have a standard field instrument that they use, and it's for all states. So to that extent, we did not have any input in the review. However, DHS partnered with other representatives in the community that work in the child welfare system and the federal people who came in to do the report and the review. And we did work with them side by side throughout the review. So to that extent, we did have some leeway in trying to explain or to talk about certain issues that may have come to their attention.
But I think you bring up a really good question. What is it you measure and how is that decided and what exactly does it measure?
Yes, yes, Madam Chair. It is. Because you now have to decide what your performance measures are, what the metrics are, to get to the endpoint. Because if you're not measuring the right thing, people will adjust to what is being measured, and then they'll forget about what's not being measured. So, as a manager, are we asking the right questions?
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, that goes exactly back to your earlier discussion about what constitutes rigorous and appropriate oversight. I think that committees like this, in conjunction with our management, should make the decision as to what we want to measure, what we think is important. Then we should welcome in federal reviewers or anyone else who reviews, accept their snapshots, and work to band-aid or celebrate the success, if that's what happens, of their review. But that shouldn't alter our path toward what we conceive to be success. That's the thing that I think is lacking, is a mutual determination of what is success and the charting of a path toward it.
I look at the long-term care community, and if the feds came in and looked at our long-term care system, I know it's fraying at the edges or broken, but Oregon is so different than Pennsylvania, for example, that I'm afraid that those measurements in Pennsylvania wouldn't work here in Oregon, and thank goodness they wouldn't work here because we do things differently. And so is that same thing true of Oregon and Child and Family Services? Or because I have confidence in McKinsey's ability to do what we've asked them to do, what we paid them to do. The question is, did we ask them to do the right thing?
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, I was with you right till the end. When we switched to McKinsey, I think they did exactly what we've asked them to
Thank
do.
You. Okay.
The federal government, I think they seldom do it. I'd like to ask them to do it.
Okay, that clarifies for me.
Thank you,
Madam Chair. I think one of the exciting things about what's going to come out of this transformation initiative with McKinsey is that we're going to have new performance targets. When the performance measure for child welfare is, have you reduced the incidences of abuse and neglect, that's like at the 30,000 foot level. There are a lot of things that impact whether or not our rates of child abuse and neglect go down. Frankly, how much gets reported? But the performance measures, how are we meeting the targets of reunification timelines and face-to-face visits and those? We can measure those process things, and we can attach money to those things. And so I think from a ways and means perspective, this is going to make our job a lot clearer in terms of making some choices around, do we feel like we're getting all we can from the resources we're investing? I wanted to just say, comment on Representative Maurer's thoughts about line workers being involved. I've been very impressed with the amount of response on your surveys and the amount of involvement with the union and other folks, and I think that's absolutely critical. I was out visiting child welfare and self-sufficiency workers in Beaverton a couple months ago, and I just want to share one thing about the reduce the caseworker overtime. I had folks who were telling me that they hide from their managers after 5 o'clock. They hide under their desk. They hide in a, you know, they hide because they need to stay longer to finish their job because they care about what they're doing, but there's no approval for overtime. So in some ways, I think we have some good numbers here. There's probably even a little underreporting. So when you look at these, I think we have some very dedicated workers who want to be able to do their job well. And that's what the goal is here, to so they stay. Which is, it's going to all save us money if they stay and continue to do good work.
Unless they get burned out.
Exactly.
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, the complete results of the survey, one of the interesting findings was that our workers report about 30% of their overtime.
Okay.
May we move, Madam Chair, to psychotropic medications?
Have we dealt with everything?
Well, the to walk you through these final pages, on the page entitled Larger Time Investment in Upstream Activities May Result in Efficiency Gains Downstream, what McKinsey is hinting at there is what in the next phase of the work we should be focusing on, which is if we take the time related to foster care as just an example and push some of it into the time to recruit the right foster parents and the time to match the right child to the right parent, then your time for working the case diminishes. And it's that kind of redirection and the investment of the allocation of time. The next page is the page I explained to you earlier about you have to add 1.4 investment per 1% workload gap of workers because of the time you get out of workers. And then the last page just indicates where we are in the transformation study. We're just in the task one benchmarking and baselining sort of phase, and that's where the child welfare staffing study occurred. I would point out before I leave this, however, that the study was conducted with the SSAs, 78 of them, in place, and the study was conducted with all of the child welfare workers that were on staff in place. The funding package that is coming out of Ways and Means this year does not contemplate continuing that. So what I'm sharing is that at least as we are advised, the funding package that we'll get out of Ways and Means will result in less than full staffing that was done at the time this report was done.
Thank you, Brian. And during the next legislative session, let's have an update on how this is going.
Yes, Madam Chair.
I know we wanted to get to psychotropic drugs, so.
Doctor, you want to introduce this?
I will, and I do have a couple of handouts for the committee for this part.
Madam Chair?
Yes. Thank you. While we're changing the guard here, I would like to comment on Assistant Director Johnson's last point about the budget choices we're making right now. It's unfortunate that is indeed what's going to happen, that we are not going to provide. We're not going to keep things status quo until we figure out what we can do differently. And so what we're doing is we're disadvantaging the department once again to meet the targets that we've set for them. And so I understand there are budget constraints. However, it's really short-sighted at the fact that we're not trying to keep child welfare whole in light of all the reports, this study, and other things. So, but that's true for a lot of systems right now.
That's true.
Thank you, and Madam Chair, because I failed to introduce myself earlier when I was speaking, for the for the record, my name is Mickey Cerise. I'm Deputy Assistant Director for the Department of Human Services. I work in the Division of Children, Adults, and Families. So I assume everything that I said earlier was from a non-entity, and you can take all of that. Certainly, my wife does, so... what we hope to do this morning on the psychotropic medications to inform you is to talk a little bit about the policies and practices as they existed in the past, and then a little bit of where we are today, and then, of course, the next steps and what we see as some future direction for the department, and then entertain some questions that you may have. And I'd like to take us back in that spirit to... January of 96, that was when the former policy, not the one that's being handed out to you right now, but the former policy on psychotropic medications and for children in foster care was implemented in the department. And that was 1 year before the Adoption and Safe Families Act went into effect, which was 1997, and that's the federal law that had a significant change on the child welfare system nationally. And as most of you are probably aware, from that time forward, most of the child welfare cases became much more complex. Just the logistics of the involvement with the court and the other oversight systems became much more complicated and added a lot of work to the existing workload. In a good way. It was something that I do think ASFA, the Adoption and Safe Families Act, was a good thing for the child welfare system in general, and is moving us in the right direction. Also, during that same time period, you may remember that Oregon was going through the methamphetamine epidemic, and that was it started on the West Coast and kind of moved over to the East Coast, and we were right in the middle of also dealing with some very complex cases as a result of the methamphetamine use that was taking place, and we saw an increase in the children coming into foster care. We had a strong recognition during that time period that most of our policies and procedures were lagging from those two occurrences, and we needed to revise most of those. And now I'm going to fast forward to May of 2004, when a work group in Multnomah County formed that included judges, community partners, and the Department of Human Services, specifically to look at how the department is handling children in foster care when those children are receiving psychotropic medications. And that work group met for approximately 18 months and generated a list of recommendations that they delivered to the department. And the department accepted those recommendations and implemented some of the recommendations that we could immediately. And then we also immediately started drafting new policy. And the policy that was just handed out to you went into effect in May of 2007, and that is the current policy that we have right now in the area of psychotropic medications for foster children. The difference between the two policies and some of the recommendations in the work group, I think I could categorize in two very broad areas. The work group recognized very appropriately that we were lacking some oversight in this area for children that were receiving medication. We were also, the second thing that I think they noticed is that we were not very clear in our policy or in our direction and training to foster parents and caseworkers and how to implement the policy. So this policy that was implemented in May of 2007 tried to address at least those two issues. And since the work group met around 2005, we have increased the amount of training that we provide to not only to foster parents and to caseworkers, but to also community partners. In fact, since 2005, we have delivered about 12 trainings in 12 different counties, and we've also delivered the training at two statewide conferences. And we've trained today a total of about 650 child welfare workers, foster parents, and community partners on this particular policy and the direction that the work group was pointing at. Some of the other areas, to get very specific, some of the other areas that you'll see some improvements involve direction to caseworkers, foster parents, and what their roles are. How do they interact with the child and the medical provider if a child is receiving psychotropic medications? We also have clear guidelines now in how the medications are to be stored, and also how we're to monitor those medications and review those medications periodically. Just recently, I was informed that we did a workaround in our current database system that will allow the caseworkers to enter information about the medication a child is on. For instance, the dosage, the type of medication, how often the child is receiving the medication, and other pertinent information that would help inform a caseworker to know whether or not they need to refer that for a second opinion or to refer that to our nurse who's in central office and can serve as a consult for those caseworkers. And that should be in effect in May of this year. The other thing that we did in this policy is we clearly outline the parties of the case need to have a notice anytime a child receives psychotropic medication or anytime that medication the child is receiving is altered or discontinued. So there's a number of steps that we've taken over the last year or so to try to move in the right direction. We know we have a long way to go. Where we are right now, we think we have a pretty clear frame of what the problem is and the direction that we need to head. And to that extent, Dr. Goldberg, in November of 2007, asked Dr. Walter Schaefer if he would chair a committee of individuals to look at medication management, not just for this population, but for the entire population served by DHS. We have a number of target populations, as you're aware, and Dr. Goldberg saw this as an opportunity to better enhance all of the areas and all of the clients that we serve. However, Dr. Goldberg did ask Dr. Schaefer to consider psychotropic medication and being used by foster children as a priority and to use that as the first project that they tackled. And the second handout I gave you is a draft report that came from Dr. Schaefer's work group. And with your permission, I'm going to turn this over to Dr. Schaefer and let him walk you through the key elements of that report and give you an overview.
Thank you. Dr. Schaefer, would you identify yourself, please?
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Walter Schaefer, and I'm the medical director for the Division of Medical Assistance Programs in DHS. And as Mickey Cerise said, I had the privilege of leading this DHS team that was charged with looking at the issues surrounding the use of psychotropic medications in foster children. And it became rapidly apparent to this group that although there's a lot of medication being prescribed and we need to develop better oversight of that, the real issue is how to develop a system of care that meets the emotional and mental health needs of these vulnerable kids. So our real goals, and that's in our mutual efforts together, are to assure the safety of the foster children who are on medications, but mainly to improve the overall quality of mental health care that they receive so that we can decrease the need for so many medications. So I want to tell you what we found as far as the current use of the medications, and then what we're recommending in the report that has been distributed is a draft report. We're still, this work group is still meeting, but let me tell you what the findings were. First of all, the incidence of emotional and behavioral problems in foster kids is very high, and just looking at the data from our administrative data from Oregon, there's an 11% rate of depression identified in these kids, 12% rate of post-traumatic stress disorder, 21% attention deficit disorder. If you look at the medical literature on foster children, the estimates are 40% to 80% rate of emotional and behavioral problems in the foster children population. So emotional trauma is sort of by definition pretty much universal in these kids, but when you add together physical trauma and the drug use of the parents, methamphetamine and so on that you heard about this morning, it creates a situation where there are a lot of emotional and behavioral risks and problems. And so what we've had in the last few years is more foster children and more complex needs and more medications available, and the medications are plentiful. And the 27% of the foster children are on some sort of psychotropic medication, and that's defined as any medication intended to alter or affect thought processes, moods, or behavior. So these are the stimulant medications, the antidepressants, the antipsychotics, the mood stabilizers. 16% of the foster children are on a stimulant medication. 9% are on one of the atypical antipsychotics. And these are rates that are 5 to 6 times higher than the non-foster children on Oregon Health Plan. So the medications are felt to be effective by the prescribers and by some of the medical studies. So the main medical issue is not so much effectiveness, but safety, and that's really the highest concern. There are no long-term safety studies on most of these medications in children. Particularly the antipsychotic medications are not. The atypical antipsychotics are not approved for use by the FDA in children, so much of the prescribing is what we would call off-label use. So the
yes,
just a clarifying question. Did you just say that most of the medications for our foster children are being prescribed for off-label uses?
Madam Chair, Representative Gelser, it depends on the category of medication. The atypical antipsychotic medications generally have not been approved for use in children. The other types of medications, like the stimulant medications, have been, and the antidepressants, although they're used in children, there are warnings for their use that are pretty significant. But they are approved. Some of them are approved for use. So it's just that it depends on the category of medication, but there are a lot of. There's a lot of this medication use that's not FDA approved in children.
Want to follow up?
Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I understand if you'd rather wait to get through the presentation first, but another number that you mentioned was the comparison of children within the Oregon Health Plan who are foster children who are receiving these drugs and children who are not foster children who are receiving the drugs. And I mean, I just have a layperson's mind, certainly not a medical mind, but when I think about the use of medications, I tend to think about some sort of a medical organic problem rather than some sort of an imposed problem because something bad has happened to me. The difference being if I have an organic psychological or mental health disorder, medication might help me chemically manage that. But if I've had a trauma to my life, perhaps access to mental health services other than drugs would better help me in the long term be able to deal with the ongoing crises and stresses in my life. And I guess I'm wondering, one, if that's true, if there's any comparison in the long run of the health of those children within the Oregon Health Plan that are on and off these medications, and then also if there's been any investigation of the long-term incidence of substance abuse among those kids in foster care who learn to manage their crises through drugs and medications rather than coping skills and learning how to sort through emotions and frustrations.
Madam Chair and Representative Kelser, that obviously that's a big question. I think the clearest answer is no. There are no long-term studies on what the use of all these medications in children will result in long-term. So it's a practice that for many of these kids does seem to be effective in improving their behavior, but the long-term safety has not been established. And I think the observers of this would suggest an agreement with what you're suggesting, that it would be better for us to have a system that promotes more appropriate emotional and behavioral growth in these kids rather than a system that just prescribes medications. So that is the direction of what our DHS team is recommending, that we develop a system, a mental health access that will increase the likelihood that these kids will get mental health services rather than medications. And as far as the long-term substance abuse, I'm not personally aware of the studies that would show what the risks are, but I can check into that. That would be of interest.
Thank you, and thank you for indulging my questions. The last question that I had on this point, you just mentioned that the use of the medication is successful for the children because they're better able to manage their behavior. And I'm wondering how that's measured and if there's a way to measure the health of the child versus the ability of the adults in that child's life to manage their behavior, and if there's a distinction in that. Do we say that the medication is working because then it's easier for the adults in that child's life to deal with that child, or do we say it's successful because we have some sort of a child-centered measure that shows that that child is somehow healthier with the use of these drugs?
Madam Chair, Representative Gelser, I think what we have currently is a combination of both of those means of measuring success that you mentioned. A lot of the requests or identified needs for medication are from, in the case of foster children, the foster parents who want to be able to keep these children with behavioral disturbances in their foster home and say to the doctor, we need to do something, otherwise I can't keep this child. Medication is prescribed. If the behavior improves, that a lot of times is the means of measuring success. So a lot of times it is the foster parent observations that are used to measure success. We all of these diagnoses and problems are kind of assessed by observation. There aren't lab tests or X-rays for most of these things. So the main standard is observation of behavior. It depends on the type of medications. Certainly for the stimulant medications, there are more, I would say, objective measures of classroom performance, observations from teacher, foster parent observations that are used to measure success. All of these diagnoses and problems are kind of assessed by observation. There aren't lab tests or X-rays for most of these things. So the main standard is observation of. It depends on the type of medications. Certainly for the stimulant medications, there are more, I would say, objective measures of classroom performance, observations from teachers and from the foster parents that are sort of standardized. For other types of behavioral problems that we're treating, we don't have such good objective measures. And of course, the younger the children, the harder it is to measure the success. So we get more concerned as the younger the children are.
Representative Olson,
you have a
question?
Yeah, thanks, Madam Chair. Dr. Schaefer, I'm just kind of curious. I'm listening to all these numbers that you've been throwing out at us here this last few minutes and everything, and I'm just absolutely overwhelmed and thinking, boy, this is one ugly picture. When you conducted your research in the work group, did you kind of do a comparison at all of where Oregon is to other states? The same dilemma, same scenario. I'm just curious where we're at compared to other states.
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, there are some comparisons with other states, I would say that Oregon is in the kind of the middle of the pack as far as these problems, and it's certainly not just an Oregon problem, it's a national problem. We don't have a lot of good directly comparative evidence with other states, and in fact one of the things that we're embarking on is a comparative project. This topic of particularly of the use of the antipsychotic medications in children is such a priority to the Medicaid medical directors in the various states, people like me, that we're doing a multi-state data comparison so we'll be able to directly compare. But in the past, Oregon's rate of use of these medications is kind of in the middle of the pack. There are some steps that can decrease the use of these medications, and in states that have instituted more oversight and monitoring and more mental health support for the kids, the rates of medication use have decreased. So we know there are some positive steps that we can take to improve the situation.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Why don't you continue? I want to allow plenty of time for questions. And
right, thank you, Madam Chair. So, the points are, you know, that I've been trying to make is that the mental health problems are very prevalent and the medications are very prevalent. The problem is the other mental health services are not prevalent, not easily accessible. The caseworkers that are supposed to be responsible for getting these kids to mental health care are overwhelmed, as you've heard, and of course the mental health services are to some extent understaffed and overwhelmed by their caseloads, and the linkage between the child welfare and the mental health services is not, we don't have a good system to directly link those two. So an example of this is that mental health assessments for children on entry into foster care are required within 60 days. So 100% of the kids should have a mental health assessment. Our actual rates are in the 35% range for children over 3 in foster care receiving some sort of mental health service within 60 days. About half of them receive a mental health service within 120 days, but we're not coming anywhere close to the 100%. So it's basically a situation where medications are being prescribed because other psychosocial supports are not available, and that's a message that we've heard loud and clear from the foster parents and from the prescribers in talking to the pediatricians and the child psychiatrist, that the number of medications, the doses of medicine are higher than they would need to be if other psychological and social supports were more available.
Fred, let me ask you a question. So mm-hmm. That's because the mental health services are not available in the communities, or you don't have the money to pay for it, or why is that?
Madam Chair, it is a combination of what you mentioned and a lack of intentionality on the part of DHS. We fail to fully accept the responsibility that we have to get that. We this is, in my opinion, thus far from the research I've done, we push too much of this off on the foster parent. We need to be more assertive in getting this done ourselves. We are working on raising that number.
So you were depending on the foster parent to seek out the mental health services, and instead it was easier to get the psychotropic drugs, I'm assuming, am I?
I think the Dr. Schaefer will tell you, Madam Chair, that I'll be interested to hear myself. I think we'll tell you that most of the percentage of psychotropic medication is prescribed by psychiatrists, but most of the children are taken to their family physicians by foster parents, not to appropriate mental health officials.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was going to wait, but since we're on this topic, I went back and looked at the Child and Family Services Review Report, because we talked about this yesterday, about the well-being factor and how we're not meeting mental health needs. Well, back in 2001, your PIP, your Performance Improvement, whatever plan, one of the things you were going to do was provide agency staff and foster parents training on how to access mental health services and advocate for services in an effective manner. So clearly that didn't work. Or didn't work to the degree that you wanted it to work. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, no, briefly it did work. Let me give you an example, if I may. Marion County is a great example. While there was some money, Marion County put a mental health professional at our child visitation facility. And when children would come for a visit with parents, there was an observation period and there was then an evaluation, and our numbers went up. Unfortunately, they lost their funding to have that person there, and we've never been able to replace it. And that was one of the... So it's back to the resource question.
Follow-up, Manager?
Follow-up. I want to make sure we get to Dr. Schaefer.
Thank you. I just want to make one point. I do think it's appalling that we're only in the 30% range when these children, obviously with high needs, aren't being assessed, even within 60 days. I guess I would like to hear back, maybe in the interim, I'd like to see the managed care plans here, the MHOs talking about how they're doing with this. These are Medicaid kids. It's not like they're uninsured. So I'd like to know if we're going to prioritize that population with our managed care plans and figure out, and I'd like to see a package of what we need to get there to meet some of these numbers. It's fine for within CAF to provide different staffing and doing some things, but there's obviously a disconnect here with the managed care plans. And
Madam Chair,
I'd like to hear why that is.
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, Bob Nickel has met with the managed care plans on our behalf on exactly that question. They've had this discussion. They're willing and frankly eager to, well, perhaps eager is overstatement. let's go back to willing. Willing to participate and to meet this need. I agree with you wholeheartedly. The only thing I would disagree with you, Representative Kotek, I think appalling might be too kind.
Just being generous. Thank you.
Representative Gelser, very fast.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On this point, I think that one of the issues is that broader issue of our reimbursement rates from the managed care providers and from our Medicaid plan for the mental health services. I know in my legislative district recently, the Children's Farm Home has shut down to outpatient mental health for kids who have the funding, who are really high-risk, high-need kids, and nobody can afford to treat them. So they are sitting there untreated as danger. I mean, there's danger to them. There's danger to the community. We need to, again, look at what are we doing in terms of advantaging or disadvantaging these children through the policies and budget decisions that we make here. When you have kids that have financing and you can't get to the supply because they aren't able to afford to stay in the business, that's another piece of the problem that we need to address.
Yes.
Representative Maurer.
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek hit the nail on the head. I have concerns that that access is an excuse in this case, because they're categorical eligible and that there are resources out there. The reality is most of these kids, 75% of them, are going to be fine. We're not going to find a problem. And so you don't need a psychiatrist. You know, just a primary care provider is going to be able to do a normal assessment and say, yes, everything is fine. And you're right, it's too kind, and so I just am extremely frustrated, and the only thing I'm going to say, and I'm not going to say anything else unless I think of something else, is that you've got DHS in its role, or CAF in its role, and then you have the providers themselves. The providers are the start of this problem. If they're over-prescribing, then something's wrong. You know, if are they being pressured by the parents? Absolutely. Are they being pressured by marketing? Maybe. But it's somebody saying, you need to give this child drugs. And a provider rolling over and saying, okay, when they shouldn't. And the providers need to be a huge part of this conversation to say, if you prescribe psychotropic drugs, then you had best have it documented while you're doing it. And I know they're supposed to do that. And this is a comment.
Madam Chair, and Representative Maurer, you know, I think there's a lot to respond to, but I will say that the providers in the managed care organizations, the medical directors for the Oregon Health Plan are more than willing to use the foster children as a model for how we can improve the linkage of care between the prescribers of the medication and the mental health system. And I think if we want to pick out if we can't do everything in an excellent fashion, at least we should provide the care to the foster children in an excellent fashion. And the managed care organizations are more than willing to develop a model that links the mental health and prescribing. We just have to come up with a quality improvement process and some demonstration projects to really develop the best model, because that's something that we're lacking. So there's certainly a responsibility on the part of the providers, but there's also a responsibility on the part of DHS and child welfare. And at the moment, child welfare has only one nurse to review the medications of almost 2,000 foster children on medication. So clearly we have a capacity and a resource problem within DHS. And what these kids actually need is a wraparound planning process, the ones that have the most complex needs, so that all of their needs are looked at in a holistic fashion, in a fashion that promotes the emotional and behavioral development and not just the use of medications. So let me just get to what our work group has recommended as being needed. And although the draft report I gave out is fairly lengthy, there is an executive summary that on the first couple of pages that outlines the recommendations. But a lot of this is building capacity, regional staffing to address the healthcare and mental health care needs, regional staffing by nursing personnel and by mental health personnel to help the caseworkers, help the foster parents with reviewing medications, to educate the caseworkers and the foster parents about these medications, to make sure that truly informed consent has been given for the use of these medications, and to make sure that the mental health assessments and services are being provided. One thing we're recommending is a smaller caseload for the kids with really complex needs, a specialty caseload level. And we're recommending, at least on a part-time basis, a medical director for child welfare. There are enough children on medication that there's a couple of reasons that a medical level person is needed. One is to have the credibility to be able to review the prescribing with the prescribers. And another is to develop the policies and guidelines for medication use in the foster children population, and to develop the system of integrating a system of care for mental health services. our report has outlined a framework for what the department should do, but the most specific planning needs to be in the next phase by people that are actually involved in direct service to foster children, and include the stakeholders who have significant interests: the foster parents, the juvenile court system, the biologic parents, all of those. Representatives from all of those areas need to be included in the specific development of the what the department is going to do. And one concept that needs to be revisited is the level of prescribing that serves as a trigger for review. There are some in the rules that were adopted in May 2007. There are some red flags of prescribing that should prompt a review, and these need to be reviewed. The current triggers are prescribing for children less than 6 years old, prescribing of more than 3 psychotropics at one time for one person, prescribing of more than one class of medications at a time, like a stimulant and an antidepressant at the same time, and prescribing that's done on an as-needed or PRN basis. So those guidelines need to be revisited by the stakeholder, with input from the stakeholders and with input, more input from the prescribers. And then at the agreed upon level of complexity of prescribing, certain things need to be required: a complete treatment plan, so that the kids are not just getting medications but the mental health services. Consultation with a child and adolescent psychiatrist should be required at that level, and consideration of requiring informed consent by DHS and not just by the foster parent, which is the current situation. So you can read through the rest of the recommendations. I think I probably led you through enough, but I think that this is an area that we, again, should use as a model for improving our system of care. It will definitely take some funding as far as not only staffing but education and training of the foster parents and the caseworkers on these medication and mental health issues. And I'd be glad to answer further questions.
Thank you so much. Let's see. Representative, do you have your hand up?
Silent one down here in the end.
Yes,
taking this all in. And I don't want to take away at all from the needs within the department of better addressing this, but there's just one piece that I haven't heard mentioned here today, and I want to throw it out for our consideration as well as yours. When we talked about the possibility of doing follow-up discussion with the managed care organizations around access and a variety of things, and some of the triggers for prescribing, there was a lot of focus on the foster parents, and I haven't heard any mention of the education community, which I think are also a trigger for prescription for medication usage, is the challenge of helping children with complicated situations succeed in the educational community, and the inability of that in that part of their world to have adequate staffing or whatever is needed to perhaps work through the behavioral changes and make that happen. So I think I'd just like to lay out a suggestion that we might include that input into part of this overall conversation, and as you put together your stakeholder groups who might be looking at the department review. We're talking about the court systems and the biological and foster parents, but I don't want to lose the some look at the importance of that piece of a child's life, which is their day in the school system, and how we can better interact with the educational community to meet the needs of the child.
I think Representative Cowan, sort of toward the end of his report, he does mention.
I didn't get to the last page, I'm sorry. I was focused on the
foster parents, and I agree with you, that would be a very important part of this process. Representative Maurer, did you have a question?
Yes, ma'am. And this is a kind of a technical question about the Medicaid billable mental health contacts. I noticed that you used the term a mental health procedure and use diagnosis code 90801 or an H0031, but it is very possible that a mental health assessment could be included in a standard office visit, such as the 99214, and that you would have to parse that out because it's not necessarily evident that that occurred in that visit. And so are you excluding these E&M codes, basic office visit, that may have incorporated a mental health assessment?
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, yes, in the statistics on mental health services, the regular office visits by a primary care physician or psychiatrist that wasn't associated with the mental health clinic would not have been included. So you're right, there may be mental health services that aren't included in these statistics. However, what it means is that if only 30 or 35% of the children have a mental health service, it means that they're not linked to the mental health system. And that is a linkage that they would all benefit from. So you're right, we're underestimating, and you know, it's not that these children can't get good mental health assessments by the primary care doctors or other physicians that they're seeing, but it does indicate that they're not linked into the mental health system if they haven't had one of these codes.
Ma'am, and I'll follow after the...
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I know we're bouncing around within the report a little bit. Back to information that I would be interested in seeing later. What kind of data do we have about children when they leave care, either to go home or they age out of the foster care system, when we know we have many children and adults that don't have access to health insurance? How many of them are able to maintain and still have access to the drugs that they've become dependent upon when they're within the system, and what happens to them when they are not able to access those? And then finally, just a comment that I have. One of the things that really concerns me about this is that ability to look into the future, the long-term impact of the kids, whether it's going off of medications, becoming dependent on medications, coming into a system because of the actions of others, being medicated as if there's something wrong with the child rather than the external forces around the child, and never being given the resources to care for themselves and manage those stressors later on in life. Because the fact is that these are very vulnerable kids who are likely to leave the system with nothing, who will be very poor, who will have very few natural resources, who are very unlikely to have access to medical care. And I'm very worried that we're setting them up for failure, and we're setting their own children up to repeat this same cycle. I mean, I think that the word appalling was a good one. Medication... You know, we've got advertisements all over the television telling us why we need drugs for all sorts of things, and I think we need to protect our children from falling into that group. Let's not make healthy kids unhealthy just in an effort to manage them, and let's make sure that we're not setting them up for a lifetime of mental illness or drug addiction just because we wanted to manage them when they were small.
Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I apologize. I had to step out, so maybe you answered this question, but you previously closed by talking about some red flags on the policy, so, awesome policy issues. What's your timeline for addressing the red flags, and are we going to see legislation in 09 to fix, and do we need to see legislation? The role of the parent, the role of, you know, the approval process along the, you know, three drugs in a child in a very young age, really problematic. So, especially in different classes. So, what's your timeline? I know I'm hearing work groups and stakeholders, but...
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, I think in the 09 session you will see some of this matter brought back in front of you. For example, you'll see the resource issue in terms of the FTEs added to CAF. I don't know that we need legislation to change our policy, and now we're back to oversight. The policies have to be changed, and frankly, we shouldn't wait till 09.
Good. Okay. Follow-up, though?
Follow-up.
I see CWAC mentioned. Are they the primary advisory group that will be advising on this at the next step? That's the Child Welfare Advisory Committee.
Madam Chair, Representative Kotek, they're the primary for CAF. Keep in mind that Dr. Schaefer's report is department-wide, and so it affects DD children and others throughout the entire department.
That's true. Thank you.
Colleagues, we've just gotten this today, and I think we've all been trying to read through quickly and highlight different things. It seems to me we've just scratched the surface in this. I'd really like to have another meeting. You may not be able to do it during the supplemental session, but if not, hopefully sometime soon. I'd like to come back to this. Any other brief questions or comments?
Can I make a comment?
Yes.
And perhaps before it gets to stay on people's minds, if they have questions, I can want to generate them. We could also feed them to DHS when they can come back. They could maybe answer some of those questions in the intro.
Great. Thank you all so much. I know this is a difficult issue. Thank you for your presentation. Colleagues, we have somebody here from a gentleman from CASA. Right. He asked for 5 minutes. Can we stay for a few minutes to hear him? Do we have somebody coming right away? This building? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate the time. I was very impressed with the knowledge that you already have shown on this issue and your passion for it. So I'm going to kind of restructure my comments a little bit here. I'm sorry, she just went out. There was one question asked by Representative Gelser that I wanted to give a little bit of perspective on regarding long-term outcomes.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear your representation.
Steve McCray. I'm from the CASA program in Portland, Oregon, and I was also a member of the committee that came up with the original recommendations. I've worked at CASA for 11 years. My background is in mental health and also education, and my bachelor's is in chemistry. This is something I've been studying for a long time, and one of the things that I have studied is the ADHD medication and the outcomes. And one of the things I can say is that there is not an indication that more kids are using drugs as a result of taking ADHD medications. There's not any indication that it's reduced either. Pretty much the long-term outcomes don't appear to be influenced one way or the other by these medications. And that's one of the reasons I think what the DHS representative have said has been really important, that if we want to influence the long-term outcomes, it appears from the research that the psychosocial interventions are critical, at least in the ADHD realm, but I'm guessing that that's going to apply to all the realms as well. I wanted to address the question of availability of services because that came up. There are other services that are available, but it is very difficult to get a hold of them. I think somebody mentioned, I think maybe it was Chair Tomine that mentioned that the easy thing to do is to get the medication. I think that's clearly the case. And particularly as we seem to be ceding or delegating responsibility for the mental health treatment decisions sometimes to the foster parent or to the treatment provider, sometimes just the resident central treatment provider that's doing this, they're going to tend to follow the road of least resistance because they are getting, they are having the issues immediately and they want to get an immediate response. To get medication from a doctor takes a couple days. To get a behavior management specialist into the home, which should be readily available, can take weeks or months and sometimes is impossible to obtain. It's not readily paid for. One of the things our volunteer CASAs run into is the mental health services are available, but they're limited sometimes to certain agencies, and the child will be going to one agency, and all their services need to be through that agency. That the therapists that are available may not be able to handle the kinds of issues that come up for the kids in foster care, and yet the child can't go somewhere else to get the services that aren't available, or it takes a very long time and a great deal of effort to get that to happen. One example I'll throw out is a child who was in therapy at a certain mental health provider. He had gotten services needed to be through that agency. that the therapists that are available may not be able to handle the kinds of issues that come up for the kids in foster care. And yet the child can't go somewhere else to get the services that aren't available. Or it takes a very long time and a great deal of effort to get that to happen. One example I'll throw out is a child who was in therapy at a certain mental health provider. He had gotten blown out of his foster home, of his daycare provider, because of behavior issues. And he was at this mental health provider for the entire time. We asked the therapist what the treatment plan was. This was in May. He'd just been thrown out. And they said, oh, it's the same as it is in February. So we're thinking, well, you know, if he just got thrown out of his daycare, obviously something isn't happening. Why isn't that treatment plan changing? We managed through a tremendous amount of effort to get him to go to Kinship House, which is a specialized treatment that's not paid for by Verity in Portland. When he got to that treatment, they explained to him why he was in foster care. They explained to him why he wasn't seeing his father. His father had murdered his little brother years before. They explained to him why he wasn't going back to his mom and what the next plan was. And his behavior settled down to the point where he could get into a regular kindergarten class, where he is now just going to after-school daycare. They were on the verge of putting him in day treatment and getting him onto Risperidone at that time. So that's the kind of change that can happen when you have the right service available. But the barriers to getting those services are substantial. And foster parents are also not trained to recognize the services that are necessary. And they're also not really qualified and don't feel the confidence to fight with the doctors about what should happen. The same is true for the caseworkers. One of my jobs was to talk to caseworkers about their experience, and a lot of them had the very same concerns that we have that have been eloquently expressed here, but they feel like they can't say anything to the doctors. It's like, who am I to say? So having these medical people come in as consultants for DHS is going to be important. I'll just add another idea that hasn't been mentioned here, is that there are pharmacists that we could engage with, much as the long-term care system uses consulting pharmacists and compiles data between pharmacists. We have a real opportunity here if DHS could require the pharmacies to be communicating with each other, or a certain kind of pharmacy to be used for a certain child. They could provide some perspective and some backup support if we have some concerns about how the medication's going. The other thing I think I have to say before I go, and there's plenty more that I would love to be able to say, but I think you guys are just all over this. Foster parents are not provided adequate support to deal with these kids in a lot of different ways. But one of the things that is very concerning is the way that the special rates are structured for foster parents, that actually encourages or discourages, in a sense, kids getting better. The foster parents are paid a very low special rate, a very low standard rate, which is somewhere around $370, $380 a month, something like that, less than $400 a month. And then they can get special rates on top of that based on how difficult the child in their care is perceived to be. I'm not saying that foster parents are going out there trying to create problems that aren't there, but it's really clear that if you create an incentive that pushes people in that direction, that, you know, over the aggregate, that's where people are going to end up going. An example that I can give you from my experience is a foster parent in Washington County who called and talked to me about the fact that she had had these kids in her care, three kids that were just like raised by wolves. You know, they didn't know how to use silverware. They didn't know how to use the bathroom. They were completely unsocialized. Year and a half or so later, they were sitting at the table, asking to pass the salt, using their forks and spoons. They looked really good. They were doing okay in school. The special rate nurse came out and said, well, they don't look like they're special needs anymore, and cut her special rates down. I think she deserved a medal and a raise for what she did. But we have the system built right now so that there's a disincentive for kids getting better and an incentive for them to continue to represent the children who have these issues. And I think that needs to be changed. Part of it is I think the foster parents aren't getting paid enough in the first place, and they shouldn't have to scrap and wrestle to get special rates. I think we need to pay them what they're worth, and we also could create a second tier of foster parents who are more trained. The foster parent training, I think, is 20 hours or something like that to begin with. They're just not in a position to deal with the kinds of issues that come up. And we could create a second tier of foster parents who get paid more but are also trained more and are able to deal with these issues so that the more difficult children can attend those homes. I guess I will leave it at that, since I think time is an issue for you guys, but if you have any questions for me.
So you were a part of the study group?
That's right.
Okay. And okay, any quick questions? We've lost so many of our people. You know what I would like? You obviously wrote some notes there. If you would write out a summary of what you said and elaborate on any of the other issues and send it to our staff, and we can get it around to all the committee members. And Representative Gelser, you heard, you missed one of the things that he had said. If you could elaborate on that about the prevalence of children who are taking drugs at a young age, and
the outcome measures being relatively unaffected
by
right.
And if you'd give us some information about that, maybe
I could
some
probably give
studies,
a couple of
cetera,
research
that would
studies.
Be great. Thank you for all that you do.
You're very welcome. Thank you for coming.
Okay. Any quick questions?
Thank you. Provide your contact information so we can follow up.
Yes, that's great.
I have my cards with me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
Can thank you all.
Contact information from you as well.
Okay, and we will be having a meeting tomorrow morning. We're going to have an update on the Child Care Center complaint database. So, yes, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sure this will have to take place another time, but is it Interim Director Johnston, or is it, okay, Interim Director Johnston mentioned as a result of two of our bills, he was able to do some analysis on funding and costs of adding positions and so forth and workload. That's an area that I don't know much about, and I'd love for us to talk about it. I don't know if you all have used that before in legislation or if we talk about that, but the analysis that they do in helping us to do fiscal on our bills would be very interesting to me as we move forward in some of the discussions like we had in bills we passed out of here. So I thought that would be a good point for us, this committee, to take up. Because every time we do something,
it costs money.
It costs money. And how that interprets at the department level is important. The second thing for the good of the order was on my way in today, you might have noticed I was just a little bit late.
We did do.
And you changed the room number on purpose, and I couldn't find it. And there was a report that said that there was a policy change at the hospital to announce or to otherwise inform a community when a patient had been released and put into a community. As you remember the controversy in our committee. So I just thought that was interesting. Not that we can necessarily believe everything on NPR, because I know you personally go over their news stories before they go out, Madam Chair.
Absolutely.
But I thought that was interesting, based on what we sort of had asked them to do to better communicate with law enforcement, and apparently they listened, so that's good.
Great, good. Thank you, Representative. Now, do you want that information in writing, or do you want a presentation in the future from the staff?
I just brought it up as a point of conversation for our committee when we're not under the gun of this session.
Okay, but Brian, would it be possible to put something in writing for us? Do you understand what he's asking?
Probably not.
Not entirely.
Okay, I will have him contact you, and then we'll get something in writing that perhaps we can take time in a future meeting to discuss.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. Anything else for the good of the order? I will close the Human Services and Women's Wellness meeting. Thank you.